It's not really such a mystery, Sadi,
Eriand told him, smiling slightly.
Don't you remember what Saradis said to Zith at Ashaba?
Something about something being delayed. I didn't really pay that much attention. We were in the middle of something fairly distracting at the moment, if I remember right.
She said, Be tranquil, little sister, for the purpose of all thy days is now accomplished, and that which was delayed may now come to pass. This is what she was talking about. This is what was delayed.
You know, Belden said to Belgarath, I think he's right. This isn't the first time the prophecies tampered with things in order to get the job done. That business about the purpose of all her days simply means that Zith was born for one thing, to bite Harrigan. Once she had done that, things went back to normal again.
Then the hunchback looked at Eriond.
How is it that you remembered exactly what she said? We were all fairly excited there in Irvon's throne room.
I always try to remember what people say,
Eriond replied.
It may not always make sense at the time they say it, but sooner or later it always seems to fit together.
This is a strange boy, Belgarath, Belden said.
We have noticed that on occasion.
Is it really possible?
Sadi asked the old sorcerer. That sort of intervention, I mean.
That's the wrong question to ask my grandfather, Geryon laughed. He doesn't believe that anything's impossible.
Silk was standing a safe distance away from Zith and her new brood. His eyebrow was raised slightly.
Congratulations, Zith, he said finally to the little green mother. Then he looked sternly at the others. This is all very nice, I suppose, but if anybody calls them little nippers, I'll just scream.
They had bathed and gone to bed, but Zenedra was restless, and she tossed and turned. Suddenly she sat up.
I wonder if that milk is still warm, she murmured.
She tossed back the blanket and padded on little bare feet to the door.
Do you want some, too?
She asked Geryon.
No, thanks. All the same, dear.
It would help you sleep.
I'm not the one who's having trouble sleeping.
She stuck her tongue out at him and went out into the hallway. When she returned a few moments later with her glass of milk, she was stifling a naughty little giggle.
What's so funny? He asked her.
I saw Silk.
So?
He didn't see me, but I saw him. He was going into a bedroom.
He can go in and out of his bedroom if he wants to.
She giggled again and hopped into bed.
That's the point, Geryon. It wasn't his bedroom.
Oh, Geryon coughed in embarrassment. Drink your milk.
I listened at the door for a moment,
she said.
Don't you want to hear what they were saying?
Not particularly, no.
She told him anyway. The rain had passed on through. Although there were still rumbles of thunder far to the west and jagged sheets of lightning raked the western horizon. Geryon awoke suddenly and sat upright in bed. There was a different kind of rumble outside, and it was occasionally accompanied by a shrill bellowing noise. He slipped softly out of bed and went out onto the balcony that encircled the farmyard. A long line of torches was slowly moving out there in the darkness, perhaps a half mile to the west. Geryon peered out through the tag end of the storm, then began to form up the image of the wolf in his mind. This was definitely something that needed to be investigated. The torches moved at a peculiarly slow pace. As Geryon loped closer to them, he noticed that they seemed much higher than they would have been if the torchbearers were mounted on horses. The slow rumbling sound and the peculiar bellowing continued. Then he stopped beside a bramble thicket and sat down on his haunches to watch and listen. A long line of huge gray beasts was plodding through the night in a northeasterly direction. Garrigan had seen the image, at least, of an elephant on the Isle of Vercat in Tolmurgos, when his Aunt Paul had routed the mad hermit in the forest. An image of an elephant is one thing, however, but the reality is quite something else. They were enormous, far larger than any animal Garrigan had ever seen, and there was a kind of ponderous implacability about their steady pace. Their foreheads and flanks were covered with skirts of chainmail, and Garrigan shuddered inwardly at the thought of such vast weight, though the elephants moved as if the mail were as insubstantial as cobwebs. Their sail-like ears swayed as they walked, and their pendulous trunks drooped down before them. Occasionally, one of them would curl his trunk up, touching it to his forehead, and give vent to a shattering trumpet sound. Men in crude body armor were mounted on the huge, plodding beasts. One, bearing a torch, sat cross-legged atop each huge neck. Those riding behind were armed with javelins, slings, and short-limbed bows. At the head of the column, riding astride the neck of a beast fully a yard taller than the ones in his wake, was a man wearing the black robe of a Grolem. Garrigan rose and slunk closer, his careful paws making no sound in the rain-wet grass. Although he was certain that the elephants could easily catch his scent, he reasoned that beasts so large would pay little attention to a predator who posed no real threat to them. In the presence of such immensity, he felt small, even flea-like. He did not particularly like the feeling. His own bulk approached 200 pounds, but an elephant's weight was measured in tons, not in pounds. He ranged on silent paws along the column, maintaining a distance of perhaps 50 yards and keeping his nose and eyes alert. His attention was concentrated on the black-robed Grolem astride the neck of the lead animal. The elephants moved on, and Garrigan trotted alongside the column, maintaining his distance. Then there appeared in the track ahead of the lead elephant a figure robed in shiny black satin that gleamed in the torchlight. The column halted, and Garrigan slunk closer. The satin-robed figure pushed back her hood with a hand that seemed filled with swirling light. At Ashabah, and again in Zamad, Garrigan had briefly seen the face of his son's abductor, but the confrontations with the Darshivan sorceress had been so charged with danger and dread that he had not really had time to let the features of the Child of Dark register on his memory. Now, slinking still closer, he looked upon her torch-lit face. Her features were regular, even beautiful. Her hair was a lustrous black, and her skin was very nearly as pale as that of Garrigan's cousin Adara. The similarity ended there, however. Zanduramas was a Grolem, and her dark eyes had that peculiar angularity common to all Angoraks. Her nose was slightly aquiline, and her forehead was broad and unlined. Her chin was pointed, which made her face seem oddly triangular.
"I have been awaiting thee, Naradas," she said in her harshly accented voice. "Where hast thou been?"
"Forgive me, mistress," the Grolem astride the neck of the massive lead bull apologized. "The herdsmen were farther south than we had been told." He pushed back his hood. His face was cruel, and his white eyes gleamed in the flickering torchlight. "How fares the struggle with the disciples' minions?"
"Not well, Naradas," she replied. "His guardsmen and his kandam and the rabble out of Karanda outnumber our forces."
"I have a regiment of elephant cavalry behind me, mistress," Naradas informed her. "They will turn the tide of the battle. The grass of central Peldane will be well watered with the blood of Irvan's guardsmen, Kandam, and Kerans. We will roll them back and make Darshiva secure once and for all.
I care nothing for Darshiva, Naradus. I seek the world, and the fate of one small principality on the eastern edge of Meloria is a matter of sublime indifference to me. Let it stand or let it fall, I care not. It hath served its purpose, and now I am weary of it. How long will it take you to deliver your beasts to the field of battle?
2 days at most, mistress.
Do so, then. Put them under the command of my generals, and then follow me to Kel. I will return to Hemel and gather up Uhtrath and Belgarion's brat. We will await thee in the shadow of the holy mountain of the seers.
Is it true that Irvan brought the demon lord Nahaz and his hordes with him, mistress?
He did, but that no longer concerns us. Demons are not so difficult to raise, and Nahaz is not the only demon lord in Hel. Lord Murja consented to aid us with his hordes. There hath long been enmity between Murja and Nahaz. They do war upon each other now with no concern for ordinary forces.
Mistress, Naradus exclaimed, surely you would not consort with such creatures.
I would consort with the king of Hel himself, in order to triumph in the place which is no more. Murja hath feigned flight, and hath lured Nahaz away from the battlefield. Take thy beasts there, so that they may destroy Irvan's hosts. Nahaz and his minions shall not be there to delay thee. Then come with all possible speed to Kel.
I shall, mistress, Naradus promised submissively.
A slow rage had been building up in Geryon. His son's abductor was no more than seconds away from him, and he knew that there was no way she could gather in her will before his fangs were into her flesh. And then it would be too late. He curled his lips back from his dreadful teeth and slunk closer, one step at a time. His hackles erect, his belly low to the ground. He thirsted for blood, and his hatred burned like a fire in his brain. Quivering in awful anticipation, he bunched his muscles, and a low, rumbling growl filled his throat. It was that sound that ultimately brought him to his senses. The thought that had seared his brain was the thought of a wolf, and it considered nothing beyond the immediate moment. If Xandramas indeed stood no more than a few bounds away, he could rend her flesh and scatter her blood in the tall grass beside the track upon which she stood before the echo of her shrieks had returned from nearby hillsides. But if the figure standing before white-eyed Naradus was but an insubstantial projection, he would clash his curved fangs on nothingness, and the sorceress of Darshiva would escape his vengeance once again, even as she had at Asheba. It was perhaps the thought burning in his brain that alerted her, or perhaps, as Polgara had done so often, she had merely sampled the surrounding region with her mind and had located the others. Whatever it was, the sorceress suddenly hissed in alarm.
Danger!
She snapped to her white-eyed underling. Then she smiled a cruel, mirthless smile.
But I have a form immune to Aelorn sorcery.
She tensed herself, then blurred, and then the immense shape of the dragon appeared before the suddenly terrified elephants. She spread the vast sails of her wings and launched herself into the damp night air, filling the darkness with her shrieking bellow and her sooty red fire.
Aunt Paul,
Geryon's thought flew out,
the dragon is coming.
What? Her answering thought came back.
Xandramas has changed form.
She's flying toward you.
Come back here, she commanded crisply. Now. He spun, his claws digging into the damp turf, and ran toward the farmstead as fast as he could. Behind him he could hear the shrill, panicky trumpeting of the elephants, and overhead the shrieking bellow of the vast dragon. He ran on desperately, knowing that Zandramas was immune to whatever countermeasures Polgara and the others might try, and that only the flaming sword of Iron Grip could drive her away. It was not far, though the seconds seemed like hours as he bunched and stretched in the running gait of the wolf. Ahead of him he could see the dragon's fiery breath illuminating the storm clouds roiling overhead, a fire eerily accompanied by pale blue lightning that danced in jerky streaks down from the clouds. Then she folded her huge wings and plummeted down toward the farmstead, with billows of fire preceding her. Between bounds, Geryon changed and ran on toward the gate with the sword of Iron Grip flaming in the air above his head. At the last instant, the dragon extended her vast pinions and settled into the farmyard, still belching fire and smoke. She swung her snake-like neck around, sending incandescent billows of flame into the wooden structures surrounding the yard. The seasoned wood began to char and smoke, and here and there small blue flames began to flicker their way up the sides of the door frames. Geryon rushed into the yard, his burning sword aloft. Grimly he began to flail at the dragon with it.
"You may be immune to sorcery, Zandramas," he shouted at her, "but you are not immune to this,"
she shrieked, engulfing him in a sheet of flame. But he ignored it, and continued to lash her with the blue flame of the orb and the sword. Finally, unable to bear his relentless strokes any longer, she hurled herself into the air, flapping her great wings frantically. She clawed at the air and finally managed to clear the second-story roof of the farmstead. Then she settled to earth again and continued to bathe the structure in flames. Geryon dashed out through the gateway, fully intending to confront her again. But then he stopped. The dragon was not alone. Glowing with her peculiar nimbus, the blue wolf faced the altered form of the sorceress of Darshiva. Then, even as Polgara had once expanded into immensity in Stithistor to face the god Issa, and as Geryon himself had done in the City of Endless Night, when he had come at last to his fated meeting with Torak, the blue wolf swelled into vastness. The meeting of the two was the sort of thing nightmares are made of. The dragon fought with flame, and the wolf with her terrible fangs. Since the wolf was insubstantial, except for her teeth, the dragon's flame had no effect, and though the teeth of the wolf were very sharp, they could not penetrate the dragon's scaly hide. Back and forth they raged in titanic but inconclusive struggle. Then Geryon thought he detected something. The light was not good. The sky overhead was still obscured by the last tattered clouds of the evening storm, and the sullen flickers of lightning seemed to obscure more than they revealed. But it appeared that each time the wolf lunged, the dragon flinched visibly. Then it came to him. Though the wolf's teeth could not injure the dragon, her blue nimbus could. It seemed in some way to be akin to the glow of the orb and the fire of Iron Grip's sword. Somehow, the blue glow surrounding Poledra, when she assumed the shape of the wolf, partook of the power of the orb, and Geryon had discovered that even in the form of the invincible dragon, Zandramas feared the orb and anything connected with it. Her flinching became more visible, and Poledra pressed her advantage with savage, snarling lunges. Then, suddenly, they both stopped. A wordless agreement seemed to pass between them, and each blurred back into their natural form, their eyes flashing with implacable hatred. Zandramas and Poledra faced each other as two women.
"I have warned you about this, Zandramas," Poledra said in a deadly voice. Each time you try to thwart the purpose of the destiny, which controls us all, I will block you.
And I have told thee, Poledra, that I do not fear thee,
the sorceress retorted.
Fine, then,
Poledra almost purred.
Let us summon the seeress of Kel. Let her make the choice here and now, and based upon the outcome of this meeting.
Thou art not the child of light, Poledra. Thou hast no part in the ordained meeting.
I can stand in Belgarion's stead if need be,
Poledra replied.
For the meeting between you and him is not the meeting upon which the fate of creation hinges. In that last meeting, you will no longer be the child of dark, and he will no longer be the child of light. Others are destined to take up those burdens. So let the meeting between you and me come now and in this place.
Thou wilt turn all to chaos, Poledra,
Zandramas screamed.
Not all, I think. You have far more to lose than I. Belgarion is the child of light, and he will go from here to the place which is no more. You are the child of dark. But if we have our meeting here and now, and if you are the one to fall, who will assume your burden? Irvan, perhaps? Or Agachak? Or some other? You, however, will not be the exalted one. And I think that thought might be more than you can bear. Consider it, Zandramas, and then choose.
The two stood facing each other, with the last flickers of lightning from the evening storm playing luridly among the clouds to the west, bathing their faces in an eerie light.
Well, Zandramas,
we will surely meet, Poledra, and all shall be decided, but not here. This is not the place of my choosing.
Then the child of dark shimmered and vanished, and Geryon heard and felt the rushing surge of her translocation. Chapter 15. She walked toward him with a stately, unhurried step, her golden eyes a mystery.
Put your sword away, Geryon. There is no need for it now.
Yes, grandmother.
He reached back over his shoulder and inserted the tip of his blade into the sheath and let it slide home of its own weight.
You heard, I suppose?
Yes, grandmother.
Then you understand?
Not entirely, no.
I'm sure you will in time. Let's go inside. I need to talk with my husband and my daughter.
All right.
Geryon was not entirely sure about the proprieties, and he was just a bit unsure of what his reaction might be should he attempt to assist her, only to discover that she had no substance. Good manners, however, dictated that a gentleman help a lady across uneven ground, and so he set his teeth, reached out, and took her elbow. She was as solid as he was. That made him feel better.
Thank you, Geryon.
She smiled a bit whimsically at him.
Did you really think your hand would pass right through me?
He flushed.
You knew what I was thinking?
Of course.
She laughed a low, warm laugh.
It's not really all that miraculous, Geryon. You are a wolf in your other form, and wolves are very open about their thoughts. You were speaking them out loud in 100 little moves and gestures you weren't even aware you were making.
I didn't know that.
There's a great deal of charm about it. Puppies do it all the time.
Thanks,
he said dryly, as the two of them passed through the gateway into the yard of the farmstead. Durnik and Toth were extinguishing the last flickers of flame from the scorched wall of a first-floor shed with buckets full of water carried to them by Silk, Eriond, and Zadi. The dragon had not had enough time to ignite the structures fully with her searing breath, and so none of the fires were very serious. Fulgra crossed the yard gravely with Tenedra and Velvet close behind her.
"Mother,"
she said simply.
"You are looking well, Fulgra,"
the tawny-haired woman replied, as if they had spoken together only last week.
"Married life agrees with you." "I rather like it,"
Fulgra smiled.
"I rather thought you might. Is he around? I need to talk with him as well as with you."
"He's in one of the upstairs rooms. You know how he feels about these meetings."
"Would you fetch him for me, Geryon? I have only so much time, and there are things he has to know. He's going to have to put his feelings aside this time."
"Right away, Grandmother."
He turned and went quickly up the wooden steps to the second-floor gallery and the door his Aunt Paul had indicated. Belgrath sat on a rumpled cot. His elbows were on his knees, and his face was buried in his hands.
"Grandfather,"
Geryon said gently.
"What?"
"She wants to talk with you."
Belgrath lifted his face. His expression was one of mute suffering.
"I'm sorry, Grandfather, but she says it's very important."
Belgrath set his jaw, then sighed in resignation.
"All right," he said, rising to his feet. "Let's go, then."
As the two of them started down the steps, they saw Durnik bowing a bit awkwardly to Poledra.
"Ma'am," the smith was saying.
Geryon suddenly realized that this was probably the first time the two had been formally introduced.
"So stiff and proper, Durnik,"
she replied. She reached out and lightly touched his face with one hand. Then she embraced him.
"You have made my daughter very happy, Durnik. Thank you,"
she told him. Then she turned and looked directly at Belgrath.
"Well,"
she said. There was a challenge in her voice.
"You haven't changed a bit,"
he said, in a voice thick with emotion.
"Oh, I've changed all right,"
she replied wryly.
"In ways not even you could imagine."
"It doesn't show."
"It's nice of you to say so. Did you hear the little exchange between the witch and me?"
He nodded.
"You were taking chances, Poledra. What if she had taken up your challenge?"
"Wolves enjoy taking chances,"
she shrugged.
"It adds a certain zest to their lives. It really wasn't all that risky, though. Xander Amas is the child of Dark, and the Dark spirit is gradually taking over her body as well as her soul. It's not going to gamble at this particular time. It takes too long to train replacements, and there's not that much time left before the final meeting. All right, let's get down to business. Xander Amas has her Angorak king now."
Belgrath nodded.
"We had heard about that."
"You always were good at ferreting out secrets. The coronation ceremony was fairly grotesque. Xander Amas followed the ancient Angorak ritual. Torak was supposed to be present, but she worked her way around that. It involved a certain amount of fakery, but the image of him she conjured up was convincing enough to deceive the gullible."
Poledra smiled.
"It certainly persuaded Archduke Otrath,"
she added.
"He fainted on 3 separate occasions during the ceremony. I think the oaf actually believes that he really is the Emperor now. A delusion Kalzakath's headsman will relieve him of shortly, if Otrath is unlucky enough to fall into his cousin's hands. At any rate, Xander Amas has only one more major task.
Oh? And what is that?
The same as yours. She has to find out where the meeting is supposed to take place. Don't dally on your way to Kel. You have still got a long way to go. Time is getting short. And you have to get across the Megan before Zakath gets here.
Zakath? He sounded startled.
You mean you didn't know? He moved his army into place around Magaren some weeks back. He sent out advance elements a few days ago, and he left Magaren with the bulk of his army just yesterday. He plans to blockade the river from the northern end of the Dalesian Mountains to the jungles of Kandahar. If he gets that blockade in place, you might have some difficulty getting across the river.
Then she looked at Belden.
You haven't changed much, my crooked friend.
Did you expect me to, Poledra? He grinned at her.
I thought you might at least have changed that disreputable old tunic, or that it might have rotted off your back by now.
I patch it from time to time, he shrugged. Then I replace the patches when they wear out. It's a comfortable tunic, and it fits me. The original is probably only a memory, though. Is there anything else you think we need to know? Or are we going to stand around discussing my wardrobe? She laughed.
I have missed you. Oh, one of the hierarchs of Tol Myrgos has landed at Finda on the west coast of the Dalesian Protectorates.
Which one?
Agachak.
Does he have an Ingarak king with him? Silk asked eagerly.
Yes.
Birgit, the king of the Myrgos? She shook her head.
No. Apparently Urgot defied Agachak and refused to make the journey.
Urgot defied Agachak? Are you sure? Urgot's afraid of his own shadow.
Not anymore, it seems. Your brother has changed quite a bit since you last saw him, Keldar. His new wife may have had something to do with that. She is a very determined young woman, and she's making him over to fit her conception of him.
Oh, that's terribly depressing, Silk mourned.
Agachak brought the new king of the Tulls instead, a cretin named Nathal.
Poledra looked at her husband.
Be very careful when you get to Dalesia, she told him. Zandramas, Irvan, and Agachak will all be converging on you. They hate each other, but they all know that you are the common enemy. They may decide to put aside their feelings in order to join forces against you.
When you add Zakath and the whole Malorian army to that, the place which is no more might be just a little crowded when we get there, Silk observed wryly.
Numbers will mean absolutely nothing in that place, Keldar. There will only be three who matter there. The Child of Light, the Child of Dark, and the Seeress of Kel, who will make the choice.
She looked at Eriand then.
Do you know what it is you have to do?
She asked him.
Yes,
he replied simply.
It's not such a difficult thing, really. Perhaps not,
Poledra told him.
But you are the only one who can do it. I'll be ready when the time comes, Poledra.
Then the tawny-haired woman looked again at Belgarath.
Now, I think it's finally time for you and me to have that little talk you've been avoiding since our daughters were born,
she said very firmly. The old man started.
In private,
she added.
Come with me.
Yes, Poledra, he replied meekly. Purposefully, she walked toward the gate of the farmstead, with Belgarath trailing behind her like a schoolboy anticipating a scolding, or worse.
At last,
Polgara sighed with relief.
What is going on, Lady Polgara?
Zinedra asked in a baffled little voice.
My mother and father are going to be reconciled, Polgara replied happily. My mother died, or perhaps didn't. When my sister Beldoran and I were born, my father always blamed himself because he wasn't there to help her. He and Bare Shoulders and the others had gone to Tol Mishrak to steal the orb back from Torak. Mother never blamed him, because she knew how important what they were doing was. Father doesn't forgive himself that easily, however, and he has been punishing himself about it for all of these centuries. Mother has finally gotten tired of it, so she's going to take steps to correct the situation.
Oh,
Zinedra said, with that odd little catch in her voice.
That's just beautiful.
Her eyes filled with sudden tears. Wordlessly, Velvet drew a flimsy little bit of handkerchief from her sleeve, dabbed at her own eyes, and then passed it to Zinedra. It was perhaps an hour later when Belgarath returned. He was alone, but there was a gentle smile on his face and a youthful twinkle in his eye. No one saw fit to ask him any questions.
"What time of night would you say it is?" he asked Dernick.
The smith squinted up at the sky where the last remnants of cloud were being swept off to the east by the prevailing wind to reveal the stars.
"I'd guess about 2 hours until first light, Belgarath. The breeze has come up. It sort of smells like morning."
"I don't think we'll get any more sleep tonight," the old man said. "Why don't we load the packs and saddle the horses while Paul fixes some of those eggs for breakfast?"
Polgara looked at him with a slightly raised eyebrow.
"You weren't planning to let us leave without feeding us first, were you, Paul?"
he asked her roguishly. "No, father," she said. "As a matter of fact, I wasn't."
"I didn't think so."
And then he laughed and threw his arms about her.
"Oh, my Paul," he said exuberantly.
Zinedra's eyes filled with tears again, and Velvet reached for her handkerchief once more. "Between them, they're going to wear that little thing out," Silk noted clinically.
"That's all right," Geryon replied. "I've got a couple of spares in my pack."
And then he remembered something.
"Grandfather," he said, "in all of the excitement, I almost forgot something. Before she changed into the dragon, I heard Zandramas talking with Naradas."
"Oh?"
"He's been in Gandahar, and he's taking a regiment of elephant cavalry to the battlefield."
"That won't matter very much to the demons."
"The demons aren't there anymore. Zandramas raised another demon lord, Morja, his name is, and he has managed to lure Nahaz away from the battlefield. They've gone off someplace else to fight."
Belgarath scratched at one bearded cheek.
"Just how good is that elephant cavalry out of Gandahar?" he asked Silk.
"Pretty close to invincible," Silk replied. "They draped them in chainmail, and they trample wide paths through opposing armies. If the demons have left the field, Irvan's army hasn't got a chance."
"There are too many people involved in this race anyway," Belgarath grunted. "Let's get across the Magan and leave all of these armies to their own devices."
They ate breakfast and rode out from the farmstead as the first light of dawn began to creep slowly up out of the eastern horizon. Oddly, Geryon felt no particular weariness despite a night significantly short on sleep. A great deal had happened since the sun had gone down, and he had much to think about. The sun had risen when they reached the great river Magan. Then, following Toth's gestured directions, they rode slowly southward, looking for a village where they might find a boat large enough to carry them across to Darshiva. The day was warm, and the grass and trees had all been washed clean by the previous night's storm. They came to a small settlement of mud-smeared shacks standing on stilts, with rickety docks thrusting out into the river. A lone fisherman sat at the end of one of those docks, negligently holding a long cane pole. Belgarath said,
"Talk to him, Dernek.
See if he knows where we can hire a boat." The smith nodded and reined his horse around. On an impulse, Geryon followed him. They dismounted at the landward end of the dock and walked out toward the fisherman. He was a stumpy-looking little fellow, dressed in a homespun tunic and with muddy, bag-like shoes on his feet. His bare legs were laced with knotty purple veins, and they were not very clean. His face was tanned, and he was not so much bearded as unshaven.
"Any luck?" Dernick asked him.
"See for yourself,"
the fisherman said, pointing at the wooden tub at his side. He did not turn, but rather kept his eyes intently on the floating red stick to which his line was attached, and which dangled his baited hook down into the murky water of the river. The tub was half full of water, and several foot-long trout swam in circles in it. The fish had angry-looking eyes and jutting lower jaws. Dernick squatted down beside the fisherman, his hands on his knees.
"Nice-looking fish," he observed.
"A fish is a fish,"
the stumpy fellow shrugged.
"They look better on the plate than they do in the tub."
"Well, that's why we catch them," Dernick agreed. "What are you using for bait?"
"Jade. Angleworms earlier," the fellow replied laconically. "Didn't seem to interest him. So I switched over to fish roe."
"I don't think I've ever tried that," Dernick admitted. "How does it work?"
"Cut them five in the last half an hour. Sometimes it makes them so excited you got to go behind a tree to bait your hook, to keep them from chasing you right up onto the bank."
"Well, I'll have to try it," Dernick said, eyeing the water wistfully. "Have you got any idea of where we might be able to hire a boat? We've got to go across the river."
The fisherman turned and stared at the smith incredulously.
"To the Deceiver side," he exclaimed. "Man, you out of your mind?"
"Is there some trouble over there?"
"Trouble? That child even began to describe what's happening over there. You ever hear tell of what they call a demon?"
"A few times."
"You ever seen one?"
"Once, I think."
"Well, there's no think about it, friend. If you've seen one, you know." The fellow shuddered. "It's just plain awful. Well, sir, all of Darsheva's just crawling with him. There's this Grolem. Come down from the north with a whole pack of 'em snapping and growling at his heels. Then there's this other Grolem, a woman, if you can believe that. Zandramas, her name is, and she stepped back and cast a spell and hauled some of her own out of wherever 'tis they come from. And them demons is fighting each other over there in Darsheva."
"We had heard that there was fighting to the north of here in Peldane."
"Well, those are just ordinary troops. And what they're fighting is an ordinary war with swords and axes and burning pitch and all. Well, the demons, they all went across the river looking for fresh ground to tear up and fresh people to eat. They do that, you know. Demons, I mean. They eat folks alive most of the time."
"I'm afraid we still have to go over there," Dernick told him.
"Well, I hope you're a good swimmer, then. You're going to have no luck at all finding a boat. Everybody from here jumped on anything as would float and headed downriver toward Gendahar. Guess they figured them wild elephants down there was a whole lot preferable to demons."
"I think you're getting a bite," Dernick said politely, pointing at the floating stick on the stumpy man's line.
The stick was submerging and popping back to the surface again. The fisherman jerked his pole straight up into the air, then swore.
"Missed him," he said.
"You can't catch them all," Dernick said philosophically.
"You can sure try, though,"
the fellow laughed, pulling in his line and rebaiting his hook with a dripping gobbet of fish roe he took from an earthenware bowl at his side.
"I'd try under the dock myself," Dernick advised. "Trout always seem to like shade."
"That's the good thing about using fish roe for bait," the fisherman said sagely. "They can smell it, and they'll go for it even if they got to climb a fence to get there.
He cast his line out again, and absently wiped his hand on the front of his tunic.
"How is it that you stayed behind?" Durnick asked. "I mean, if there's so much trouble round here, why didn't you go to Gandahar with the other people who left here?"
"I never lost nothing in Gandahar. Them folks is all crazy down there.
Well, they spend all their time chasing elephants. I mean, what you gonna do with an elephant once you catch him?
And the fish down there ain't worth the bait.
Besides, this is the first time I've had this dock all to myself in the last 5 years.
Most of the time,
I can't get my line in water. There's so many out here."
"Well," Durnick said, rising to his feet a little regretfully,
"I suppose we'd better push on. We're going to have to find a boat somewhere."
"I'd sure advise staying away from the Dar Shiva side, friend,"
the fisherman said seriously.
"You'd be better off to cut yourself a pole and sit right here with me till all the trouble blows over."
"Oh, I certainly wish I could," Durnick sighed. "Good luck, friend."
"Just being here with my line in the water is the best luck in the world."
The fellow shrugged, turning his eyes back to the floating stick on his line.
"If you ever go over to the Dar Shiva side, try not to get et by demons."
"I'll make a special point of it," Durnick promised.
As Geryon and his friend walked back along the rickety dock to where the horses were tethered, Durnick smiled.
"They talk differently in this part of the world, don't they?"
"Yes," Geryon agreed, remembering the gabby old man and his pig in the wayside tavern above the plains of Orsebo.
"I sort of like it, though," Durnick admitted. "Kind of free and relaxed and easy, somehow."
"I would not necessarily try to imitate it, though, if I were you," Geryon advised. "Aunt Paul might wash your mouth out with soap if you did."
"Oh," Durnick smiled. "I don't think she'd really do that, Geryon."
Geryon shrugged.
"She's your wife, and it's your mouth."
Belgorath was waiting for them atop the grassy hill rising above the village on the riverbank.
"Well?" he asked. "The fish are biting," Durnick told him seriously.
Belgorath stared at him for a moment, then rolled his eyes heavenward and groaned.
"I meant Indar Shiva," he said, from between clenched teeth.
"Oh, I couldn't really say for sure about that, Belgorath. But if they're biting on this side, it only stands to reason that they'd be biting over there too, doesn't it?"
Durnick's face was very sincere, and his tone was earnest. Belgorath turned and stamped away, muttering to himself. When they rejoined the others, Geryon briefly repeated the information that he and Durnick had gleaned from the solitary man at the end of the dock.
"Oh, that puts a whole new complexion on things, doesn't it?" Silk said. "Now what?"
"If you don't mind a suggestion, ancient one," Zadi said to Belgorath, "I think we might be wise to follow the example of the villagers Belgorath mentioned, and go on down river to Gandahar and find a boat there. It might take us a little longer, but we will avoid the demons."
Toth shook his head. The huge mute's usually impassive face had a worried frown on it. He made a quick series of those obscure gestures to Durnick.
"He says we don't have time," the smith translated.
"Is there some kind of special time when we have to get to Kel?" Silk asked. Toth gestured again, his big hands moving rapidly.
"He says that Kel has been sealed off from the rest of Telesia," Durnick told them. "Theratus has made arrangements for us to get through, but once she leaves, the other seers will seal it off again."
"Leaves?" Belgorath said with some surprise. "Where is she going?" Durnick looked inquiringly at Toth, and the mute gestured some more.
"Oh," Durnick said. "I see."
He turned back to Belgorath.
She needs to go to the place of the meeting soon. She has to be there when it happens, so that she can make the choice.
Couldn't she just travel with us?
Velvet asked. Toth shook his head again, and his gestures became more emphatic.
I'm not sure I got all that, Durnick confessed. Tell me if I make any mistakes.
He turned once more.
He says that something's supposed to happen before we get to Kel. But if it doesn't, she will have to travel alone.
Did he say what this something is going to be? Volgara asked her husband.
The way I understand it, he doesn't know, Paul.
Does he know where it's going to happen? Belgarath asked intently. Toth spread his hands.
That young lady is really beginning to irritate me.
The old man looked at Belden.
What do you think?
I don't see that we have much choice, Belgarath. If this event is supposed to happen in Darshiva, and we avoid the place, it might not happen at all, and the whole business could hinge on that.
All right, Belgarath said. We go to Darshiva, then. We have dodged demons before. The main thing right now is to get across the river before Zakath gets here.
And we're going to need a boat, Durnick said. I'll go see if I can find one, Belden said, crouching and spreading his arms.
You don't have to be too selective, Belgarath said. Anything that floats should do it.
I'll keep that in mind,
Belden replied, and soared away. Part 3. Darshiva. Chapter 16. It was not really a boat. In point of fact, it was a river barge, and its long trailing rope gave evidence that it had broken its moorings somewhere upriver and had drifted downstream with the current. It would serve, however. The only real drawback Geryon could see was the fact that it was lying in about 8 feet of water with its starboard bow staved in.
"What do you think, Belgarath?" Belden asked.
"A boat that's already been sunk once doesn't inspire much confidence," the old man said.
"How would you like to try swimming? There's not even a raft for 10 miles in either direction."
Durnick stood squinting down into the cloudy water of the river.
"It might be all right," he said.
"Durnick," Silk objected. "It's got a big hole in the front of it."
"Oh, I can fix that, provided it hasn't been down there long enough to start rotting."
He pulled off his rust-colored tunic and his boots.
"Well," he said, "there's only one way to find out."
He waded out into the river, sank beneath the surface, and swam down to the wreck. He went hand over hand down one side, stopping every few feet to dig at the wood with his knife. After what seemed an eternity, he came up for air.
"Well?" Belgarath called to him. "That side seems all right," Durnick replied. "Let me check the other."
He dove down again through the greenish water, and went up along the other side. He came up briefly, then went back down to look over the interior of the barge. Then he inspected the gaping hole in the bow. He was breathing hard when he came back up.
"It's sound," he reported, as he came dripping out of the river. "And whatever it ran into didn't damage anything major. I think I can fix it well enough to get us across the river. We'll have to unload it first, though."
"Oh?" Silk's nose twitched with curiosity. "What kind of cargo was it carrying?"
"Beans," Durnick replied. "Bags of 'em. Most of the bags burst when the beans swelled up, though."
Silk groaned.
"Maybe they belong to someone else, Geldar,"
Velvet said consolingly. "Are you trying to be funny?" "I'll help you, Durnick," Geryon offered, starting to pull off his plain tunic.
Durnick hesitated. "Thanks all the same, Geryon, but I've seen you swim.
You'd better stay on the bank. Toth and I can manage.
How do you plan to get it out of the water? Zadi asked.
Well, we have all these horses, Durnik shrugged. Once we swing it around, they should be able to pull it up on the bank.
Why swing it around?
Well, because the hole's in the bow. We want the water to drain out as we pull it up onto the beach. A whole herd of horses couldn't move it if we left it full of water.
Oh, I guess I didn't think of that.
Toth laid aside his staff, pulled off the blanket he wore across one shoulder, and waded out into the river. Eriond started to remove his tunic.
"Where do you think you are going, young man?"
Polgara asked him.
"I'm going to help unload the boat, Polgara,"
he replied earnestly.
"I swim very well. I've had lots of practice, remember?"
And then he, too, waded out into the water.
"I'm not sure I caught the significance of that,"
Velvet admitted. Polgara sighed ruefully.
"When he was a little boy, he lived with Durnik and me in the Vale. There was a river nearby, and he used to fall into it regularly." "Oh, that explains it, I guess."
"All right," Belgarath said crisply. "They're going to need lumber to patch that hole. We passed a shed about a half mile upstream. Let's go back and tear it apart."
It was well after sundown by the time Durnik got the foundered barge up onto the beach. For once, nature cooperated, and there was no hailstorm that evening. They built a fire on the beach to provide light, and the smith, Toth, and Eriond got down to work. Silk walked mournfully around the barge.
"It's mine, all right," he sighed.
"You keep well-equipped barges, Silk," Durnik said, carefully measuring a board. "This one had everything I need right in the bow. Nails, a barrel of tar, even a fairly good saw. We'll have it afloat before morning."
"I'm so glad you approve," Silk said sourly.
He made a wry face.
"This is unnatural," he complained.
"What's the problem, Keldar?"
Velvet asked him.
"Usually, when I want a boat, I steal one. Using one of my own seems immoral somehow."
She laughed gaily and patted his cheek.
"Poor, poor dear," she said. "It must be terrible to be burdened with so delicate a conscience."
"All right, ladies," Polgara said then. "Let's see to supper."
While Durnik, Toth, and Eriond worked on the patch and Polgara, Tsenedra, and Velvet prepared supper, Geryon and the others fetched more lumber and began to fashion crude oars. They continued to work, even as they ate. Somehow, everything seemed right to Geryon. All of his friends were around him, and they were all busy. Although the repairing of the boat was of vital importance, the simple chores involved seemed almost mundane, and Geryon could not lose himself in the tasks at hand, with no sense of the urgency which had attended the things he had been forced to do lately. It was almost soothing. After the ladies had finished with supper, they carried canvas buckets of water from the river and heated the water with hot rocks. Then they retired behind a screen of tenting to bathe. About midnight, Geryon went down to the water's edge to dip his sore hands into the river. Tsenedra sat not far away, idly letting handfuls of sand trickle out from between her fingers.
"Why don't you see if you can get some sleep, Tsenedra?" Geryon asked her. "I can stay awake as long as you can," she replied. "I'm sure you can, but why?" "Don't patronize me, Geryon. I'm not a child."
"You know," he said slyly, "I have noticed that myself on any number of occasions."
"Geryon,"
she gasped, and then she suddenly blushed. He laughed, rose to his feet, and went over and kissed her soundly.
"Go get some sleep, dear," he told her. "What are you doing over there?"
she asked, looking up the beach to where the others still worked.
"We're making oars.
If we just push that barge out into the river, the current's going to take us all the way down into Gandahar.
Oh. All right, then. Have a pleasant night.
She stretched and yawned.
Why don't you get me a blanket before you go back to building oars?
It took Durnik and Toth most of the night to nail a rough, tar-smeared patch over the hole in the bow, while the others fashioned crude oars fixed on long poles. Several hours before daylight, fog began to rise in misty tendrils from the surface of the river. After Durnik had liberally applied hot tar to the inside and outside of the patch, he stepped back and critically examined his handiwork. "I think it's going to leak," Silk predicted.
"Well, all boats leak," Durnik shrugged. "We can bail the water out."
It took a great deal of effort, and some fairly exotic rigging, to get the barge back into the river again. Durnik leaped aboard and went forward with a torch to examine the patch.
"A little trickle is all," he said with some satisfaction. "It's nothing we can't keep ahead of."
The fog grew steadily thicker as they loaded their packs aboard the barge. It was spring in this part of the world, and frogs sang lustily of love in the rushes at the river's edge upstream. It was a pleasant, drowsy sound. Durnik scouted several hundred yards downstream and found a shallow bank where the current had cut away the soil. He fashioned a ramp from the remaining lumber. They towed the barge down to the cut bank and loaded the horses on board.
"Let's wait until we have a little more light," the smith suggested. "Fog's bad enough, but when you add darkness to it, it's almost impossible to see where you're going. Rowing this thing isn't going to be so enjoyable that we need to paddle around in circles just for the entertainment of it."
"Couldn't we rig a sail of some sort?" Silk asked hopefully.
"Easily," Durnik replied.
He wet one finger with his tongue and held it up.
"I'll do that just as soon as you work out a way to make the wind blow."
Silk's face fell.
"While you're doing that, I need to go talk with Zenedra."
He went back up the beach and gently shook Geryon's sleeping wife awake. "You know, sometimes he has a very warped sense of humor," Silk observed. When the first light of day began to tinge the misty eastern horizon, they pushed out into the fog and took their places at the oars.
"I don't want to seem critical, Goodman," Zadi said to Durnik, who stood in the stern with his hands gripping the tiller. "But I've seen a lot of fog in Nyssa, and once it is fully daylight, you won't have the faintest idea of where the sun is. How do you plan to keep your course?"
"Well, Zenedra's taking care of that," the smith replied, pointing toward the bow.
The Riven Queen was leaning over the port side, intently watching a floating piece of wood attached to a long cord.
"What is she doing?" Zadi asked, sounding a bit perplexed.
"Well, she's watching the current. We'll be quartering it, but as long as that cord stays at the same angle from the boat, we'll be right on course. I put a mark on the rail to show her what the angle ought to be."
"You think of everything, don't you?" Zadi said, continuing to pull his oar.
"I try. You can usually avoid problems if you think your way completely through a job."
Zenedra raised one arm and pointed imperiously to starboard. She seemed to be taking her job very seriously. Durnik obediently moved the tiller. Once the eastern shore of the great river vanished in the fog, it seemed to Geryon that time had stopped entirely. There was no real sense of motion, though he bent his back over his oar with monotonous regularity. "Tiresome, isn't it?" Silk said. "Rowing always is," Geryon replied. Silk looked around and then spoke quietly. "Do you notice a change in Durnik?"
"No, not really."
"What I'm getting at is that usually he is so self-effacing that you almost forget that he's around,
But back there on the beach, he just sort of took charge.
He's always been like that, Silk. When we are doing something he doesn't know all that much about, he just follows along and keeps his eyes open. But when we come to something he knows about, he steps in and does what has to be done.
Geryon smiled affectionately back over his shoulder at his old friend, and then he looked slyly at Silk.
He also learns very fast. By now he's probably at least as good a spy as you are, and he watched you very closely while you were manipulating the bean market back there in Melsina. If he ever decides to go into business, I think you and Arblick had better start keeping a close count of your tail feathers.
Silk looked a bit worried. He wouldn't really do that, would he?
He might. You never really know about Durnik, do you?
As the sun rose higher, the fog diffused its light and the world around them became a monochrome white fog and black water with no hint at all that they were making any progress, or, if they were, that it was in the right direction. Geryon felt a bit strange, knowing that they were entirely at Saenedra's mercy. It was only her eyes on that cord lightly lying across an angled mark on the rail that kept them on course. He loved her, but he knew that she was sometimes flighty, and her judgment was not always the best. Her insistent little gestures to port or to starboard, however, showed no sign of hesitancy or lack of certainty, and Durnik obeyed them implicitly. Geryon sighed and kept on rowing. About mid-morning, the fog began to thin, and Belden drew in his oar.
"Can you manage here without me?" he asked Belgarath. "I think we ought to know just exactly what we are running into. There's all sorts of unpleasantness going on in Darsheva, and I don't think we'll want to come ashore right in the middle of it."
"And you are getting tired of rowing, right?" the old man replied sarcastically.
"I could row all the way around the world if I wanted to," the gnarled-looking little hunchback replied, flexing his oak-stump arms. "But this might be more important. Do you really want to beach this tub and find Nahaz waiting for you on the sand?"
"Do whatever you think is right."
"I always do, Belgarath, even if it makes you unhappy sometimes."
The grimy little gnome went forward toward the bow.
"Excuse me, little darling," he said to Saenedra in an exaggerated brogue, "but I must be off now."
"I need you at that oar," she objected. "How can I keep the course if everybody runs away?"
"I'm sure you can manage me, little darling," he said,
patting her cheek, then leaving a ghostly laugh behind him. He disappeared into the fog.
"You come back here,"
she shouted after him, but he was already gone. There was the faintest touch of a breeze then. Geryon could feel it brushing across the back of his sweaty neck as he rowed. The fog eddied and swirled slightly, thinning even more. And then there were looming black shapes all around them.
"Geryon!"
Saenedra exclaimed. A number of triumphant shouts came out of the rapidly dissipating fog. They were surrounded by ships that moved purposefully to block them.
"Do we make a run for it?"
Silk asked in a tense, hoarse whisper. Belgarath looked at the ships moving to surround them, his eyes like flint.
"Run," he said. "In this tub. Don't be ridiculous."
A boat had moved directly in front of them, and as they drifted closer, Geryon could see the oarsmen.
"Malorian soldiers," he noted quietly. "Sakath's army."
Belgarath muttered a few choice oaths. "Let's sit tight for a bit. They may not know who we are. Silk, see if you can talk us out of this."
The little man rose and went to the bow of their barge.
"We're certainly glad to see Imperial troops in this region, Captain,"
he said to the officer, commanding the boat blocking their path.
Maybe you can put a stop to all of the insanity that has been going on around here.
I will need your name, the officer replied.
Oh, of course, Silk said, slapping his forehead. How stupid of me. My name is Vetter. I work for Prince Keldar. Perhaps you have heard of him?
The name is familiar. Where are you going?
Actually, we were bound for Balassa down in the Thalesian Protectorates. Prince Keldar has interests there. That's assuming we can make our way across Tarshiva. Things are in turmoil there. He paused. I wonder, Captain, do you suppose you could spare us a few soldiers to act as an escort? I am authorized to pay quite handsomely.
We will see, the officer said.
Then an even larger ship emerged from the fog and moved alongside their patched and leaky vessel. A familiar face looked over the rail.
It has been quite some time, hasn't it, King Belgarion?
General Ateska said in a pleasant conversational tone.
We really ought to try to stay in touch.
Ateska wore his customary scarlet cloak and a burnished steel helmet embossed with gold. Garion's heart sank. Subterfuge was quite out of the question now.
You knew we were out here? He said accusingly.
Of course. I had people watching you on the Peldane side.
The red-clad general sounded a bit smug about that.
I felt no presence, Polgara declared, pulling her blue cloak about her.
I'd have been very surprised if you had, my lady,
Ateska replied.
The men who are watching you are imbeciles. Their minds are as vacant as the minds of mushrooms.
He looked distastefully out across the river.
You have no idea of how long it took me to explain to them what they were supposed to do. Every army has a few men like that. We try to weed them out, but even gross stupidity has its uses, I suppose.
You are very clever, General Ateska, she said in a tight voice.
No, Lady Pogra, he disagreed. I'm just a plain soldier. No officer is more clever than his intelligence service. Braedor is the clever one. He has been gathering information about your peculiar gifts from various Grolems since the Battle of Tulmardu. Grolems pay very close attention to your exploits, my lady, and over the years they have amassed a great deal of information about your abilities. As I understand it, although I'm certainly no expert, the more acute a mind is, the more easily you can detect its presence. That's why I sent those human turnips out to watch you.
He looked critically at their boat.
That's really a wretched thing, you know. Are you keeping it afloat by sorcery?
No, Durnick told him in a flat, angry tone of voice. By skill.
I bow to your skill, Goodman Durnick, Ateska said a bit extravagantly. You could probably work out a way to make a rock float, if you really wanted to.
He paused and looked at Belgarath.
I assume we are going to be civilized about this, Ancient One.
I am willing to listen, Belgarath replied warily.
His Imperial Majesty feels a strong need to discuss certain matters with you and your companions, Holy Belgarath, and I think I should advise you that you are paddling this wreck of yours directly into the middle of a hornet's nest. Sensible people are avoiding Darshiva right now.
I have never pretended to be sensible.
Ateska laughed ruefully.
I haven't either, he admitted. At the moment, I'm trying to map out a military campaign to invade that most insensible region. May I offer you, gentlemen and your ladies, the hospitality of my ship?
He paused.
I think I will have to insist, he added regretfully. Orders, you understand. Besides, we might want to pool our information while we await the arrival of His Imperial Majesty.
Is Zakath coming here?
Geryon asked. I doubt that he is more than a day behind me, Your Majesty, Ateska replied. And he is aflame with the desire to have a long, long talk with you.
What do we do, Grandfather?
Geryon's fingers asked. I don't think we have got much choice at the moment. Belden is out there somewhere. I'll let him know what is happening. He will come up with something. All right, General, he said aloud. I was getting a little tired of rowing anyway. Pass the word to the others. He motioned to Geryon. Let us seem to go along, at least until we get to the Darshiva side. Ateska's ship, while not opulent, was comfortable. They gathered in the forward cabin, a room littered with maps and various sized bits and pieces of parchment. As always, General Ateska was polite, but firm.
Have you had breakfast yet?